Welcome to Contingency FM. Welcome to our episode today. We are doing bedside chats. Respiratory is our topic today, and we are joined today by Dr. Naomi Chamberlain.
Hello.
And Matthew Nichols.
Hello.
Who's also a doctor.
Thanks.
And a fellow teaching fellow who long-time listeners should be very familiar with. Today we are going to be chatting to Naomi about her experience as a respiratory consultant. I actually met Naomi quite a long time ago now. Seven years ago. In two separate settings, and both of them I kind of put my foot in it both times. So I thought it might be fun to start off this episode by asking Naomi to recount her first experience of that.
My first experience of Phil White. What a thought. So it was back in what?
I was in third year.
2013.
Yeah.
And it was the FOCP teaching rotations, and it was respiratory week, and everybody had been split off into little groups to learn how to do a respiratory examination. And there was a certain student that kept catching the eye of every single tutor on the rotation. And there was a coffee break at which somebody came out and went, "Have you had that really tall one yet?"
Oh, no.
I hadn't. And then as soon as the next rotation started, you came into the room and I knew exactly who they were talking about, because the whole time you were cracking jokes and not necessarily taking it seriously. And I think I may have had to tell you to take the whole situation more seriously. But thankfully, you didn't remember me at all, because the next time we met, you hadn't recalled that incident whatsoever.
I had actually done a lot of reflecting after that moment. I bucked my ideas up and changed my life around, really. I think it's fair to say I did a lot of growing up in my first term of third year. I kind of started to realise what it was all about a bit more.
Mm.
It was a year and a half later, and I met you, it was in church. Mm. And someone said you're a doctor. I was like, "Oh, are you?" I didn't know anything about medical training grades at all. So I was like, "Are you a CMT? And at that point, you're already a consultant. You're like, "Oh,
yeah.
Actually, I'm a consultant." So I was like, "Oh, cool, okay."
Highly awkward. It wasn't highly. I was very flattered that you thought I was young enough to be a CMT. So yeah, that was grand.
So I've also educated myself on training grades since then. That was when I realised I should probably know this. Anyway, Matthew, you have our first related to the podcast question.
Yeah. So what drew you to chest medicine?
So I think really the main thing was the variety. So if I think back to being a medical student, I went to uni in Liverpool, and the curriculum there was really focused towards getting people to end up as a GP. We did loads of GP right from the first year. And I'd always thought I would want to be a GP or do some far-flung type of medicine in a foreign country. And so I'd done an extra year at the School of Tropical Medicine in Liverpool as well. But basically, as soon as I started as an F... Well, I wasn't an F1 then, because I'm that old. I was a PRHO, an old-fashioned houseman. And I realised I just really like working in a team and with lots of other people and with all the allied health professionals and all that kind of stuff. So every time I tried to convince myself that I wanted a GP, it never really worked. Mm. And so I just ended up staying in hospital medicine. So I was sort of on the cusp of all of these different training schemes happening. So I did a pilot F2 year, which wasn't really an F2 year, it was lots more medicine. And then I did a pilot CT year as well. And then MTAS happened, which is how I moved up here. And just continued to really enjoy being in the hospital setting and working in a team. And I suppose right from when I was right from my first medical jobs, I was always thinking, what speciality do I want to do? And as it happened, I ended up doing lots of cardiology, lots of COTI, But it took quite a long time before I had my first respiratory job. And I'd done it as a second year medical student and had a placement. But at that point, I was placed with a consultant whose specialist interest was COPD. And so all his clinics were just COPD because he was from a tertiary centre. And so all I ever really got to hear about was phlegm and wheeze. And I thought that's all respiratory was about. So I wasn't actually that taken with respiratory from that second year medical student experience. But as soon as I started doing it as an SHO, I was doing palliative care for the lung cancer patients. I was doing chest drains, so practical procedures. I was looking after people in acute settings, so acute asthma, pneumonia. And it was just this wonderful variety every day of looking after patients with all sorts of different problems. It wasn't just about phlegm. But there was all the practical procedures as well. And I think one of the things that surgeons often say that they get a lot out of doing surgery is that they can literally do something there and then that makes the patient get better. And I think respiratory is one of the only medical specialities where you can do that as well. So, for example, if somebody is really, really breathless because they have a pleural effusion, you can put a chest drain in and immediately they can breathe and they feel so much more comfortable. So you can genuinely make a difference right there and then. So that was one aspect, was the fact that it was just so interesting and every single part of the disease process was fascinating and the patients were lovely. That was one thing. Despite everything that happens with respiratory patients, they all tend to be just lovely. And maybe that's my opinion. It's perfectly possible. But they're lovely people. And actually, generally, I would say that respiratory physicians are just really good fun as well. And they're nice people to work with. And so that was something that really helped me decide which speciality I wanted to do. I think by the time that I got to applying for my reg jobs, I'd whittled it down to gastro, respiratory and palliative care. And at the time that we were given three options, because again, it was a different setup to how it is now. And the palliative care, I really, really enjoyed that aspect of making sure that somebody was comfortable, their symptoms were well controlled, all that kind of thing. But I realised that probably I would miss the acute side of things if I just did palliative care. And with the gastro, you still get to do all the drains, you get to do the scopes, but it's just a little bit more smelly. So I plumped for respiratory, and I'm very glad that I did. So it's much less smelly, but you still get all the good fun stuff. And the people are all great.
So I guess you told us a little bit about some of your favourite parts of that. You've mentioned chirpy patients, a good team, and sort of being able to do very meaningful things in terms of making people a lot better. What are some of the tougher aspects of the job?
So I think the thing that I specifically warn our junior doctors about in the induction and try and make sure that I really look out for them for throughout the whole of their placement is the fact that sadly respiratory has got a high death rate, a high mortality, and by very all of you will be familiar with the concept of when you're resuscitating somebody, start with the airway, then go to breathing, even before you get to cardiac and everything else. So if you can't breathe, it's fairly fatal. And the reality is that if you did a job like rheumatology, for example, or dermatology, you would very rarely have to deal with death. But in our job, we're dealing with it on a very regular basis. And whilst that is professionally a privilege to be looking after somebody at such an acute moment of their life, a time when their family will never forget this interaction with the medical and nursing team, it can take its toll. And actually, especially, for example, if one of the junior doctors is looking after a bay and in a week three of their patients die, that's actually quite a lot to come to terms with. And I mean, I can still remember the first patient I looked after as a house officer who was on my ward who died, that I'd had something to deal with. And I can also still remember vividly the face of the first patient who died acutely when I was on call. And that was now 15 years ago, 16 years ago. That doesn't leave you. There have been, sadly, plenty of people I've looked after since who've died that I don't remember, but there are some certain circumstances that's really tough. But I think what I would say is throughout our training, we work out how to deal with that and how to, you know, think about it, manage it, all that sort of thing, in terms of coping strategies, healthy coping strategies. But I think that is one aspect that you can't ignore if you're a sentient being. You know, it can take its toll. I don't think it does for everybody, and I think we do grow sort of strategies, but I think that would probably be the genuinely the hardest thing. It is also a busy specialty, but I think most people would always say that their specialty is busy. But you do have a high, if you think about the acute medical take, for example, a large majority of that involves respiratory problems. Winter is always exceptionally busy because you have flu and everything else. Corona has been interesting. I think a lot of hospitals have used that, have seen that as a general medical problem. But respiratory has still been looking after the most acutely unwell patients, the one that need respiratory support, ventilatory support. So you do continue to see the hyper-acute sort of setting of things. And what you'll find is that most people who are attracted to medicine, to respiratory medicine, are attracted to that aspect of medicine, and they thrive in that circumstance. And so it's not a problem. Whereas the people who don't thrive in that circumstance will choose an entirely different speciality. But I would say that certainly the emotional side of things is probably the hardest thing to deal with. I mean, it's funny because in the past you might have said lung cancer and a lot of respiratory medicine has got a very poor outcome and it feels quite nihilistic, but I genuinely don't feel that about our patients these days, and there's all sorts of really exciting advances that have happened even just in the last 5 years since I've been a consultant in terms of lung cancer treatments that are available, and you know, management of COPD and all that kind of stuff.
Biologics and things used in lung cancer.
And people are talking about immunotherapy for small cell lung cancer, which, you know, this might be a bit advanced for your listeners, but at the same time, actually, that's nothing that we would have ever considered before. There's all sorts of things that are changing. So it is a very exciting area. So I think that's not a problem so much anymore.
So our second irrelevant question of the day is, would you rather have a 1 minute conversation with your past self or your future self?
Where do you come up with these?
I've got no idea what my future self is going to be like, so I'd probably go past. Not that it would make any difference.
What would you say?
It depends which bit of my past it was.
And do you think your past self would think, why is my future self speaking to me, which makes it all a little bit sort of circular?
Yeah, it depends if I had the opportunity to change anything, and that would depend on what part of my past I spoke at, I suppose. I'd probably quite enjoy having a conversation with my 4-year-old self. I think that would be quite interesting. I was quite an imaginative little girl.
How about you, Matthew?
Future self, I think.
What would you ask?
You know, you get into it, aren't you? I don't think I'd have any specific questions just for fear of discovering something I didn't want to.
How did you end up in prison, Matthew? And how can I avoid this? Yeah.
I'm not sure I was that interesting when I was younger, so that's probably why I'm going for future self, in the hope that I've become interesting.
How about you, Phil?
Oh man, I definitely wouldn't talk to my future self, because I think I would probably, like, if I look at most things in my life, they've not necessarily happened because I've tried to make them happen. They're good things. But like, I feel like when I've tried to make stuff happen, I've often like jumped the gun in terms of like when things are ready. And so I think if I talk to my future self, I'd be like, right, I'm doing that, I need to start the day. And I'm overwhelmed by the question now. It's too much.
You're on the receiving end.
Yeah, I know. Matthew, have you got our next question?
Thanks, Phil.
Do you want me to remind you of the next question? It's the one where you ask about where the house trainees
are. Thank you, Phil. So I suppose I could preface this by saying I'm doing my first respiratory job in December. Do you have any top tips for how to get the most out of a respiratory job as a foundation doctor or as a junior trainee?
Yeah, so I think it varies depending on which stage of training you're at. So as a foundation, it's an excellent job to do because you get such a great introduction to medicine as a whole. Mm. And once you've done, like, the F1s that we have who start in August on respiratory find that every job after that is just straightforward because they know how to deal with sick patients, they know when to be concerned, when to escalate things to seniors and all that kind of stuff. So it's just a brilliant foundation because you do have some of the sickest patients in the hospital under your care. And that sounds a bit daunting, but actually you'll find that most respiratory teams are very supportive. Mm. And so that support is always there. In terms of as a foundation doctor, I always get my F1s who start, I say try and get at least 12 out of your 15 core procedures signed off in your first placement because there's so many opportunities for doing that. Do it then in your first placement and then you don't have to worry about it for the rest of the year. I don't know if it's that possible to do in other specialities, but certainly it is for respiratory. Just make the most of those training opportunities. Make the most of the stuff. I think what I would say at any stage of training is know your curriculum. Mm. Know what needs to be signed off. And therefore, when those opportunities come up, you know, oh, actually, that's something that I need to get. Mm. So the IM injection for foundation years seems to be really difficult. But if you know somebody's getting a B12 injection, you can say, oh, I need an can I do your IM injection? And then, or if somebody needs a blood transfusion, you know that needs signing off. So you can get that signed off at the opportunity when it comes up, because it doesn't happen every week. It doesn't happen every month. So just be aware of that, and it really sets you up very well. Mm-hmm. In terms of respiratory specific, get to know oxygen therapy, because that's the fundamental. So the difference between type 1 and type 2 respiratory failure, who would need controlled oxygen, who's okay having nasal cannulae, when you would worry about low sats, when you would worry about high sats. Try and get that concept sorted in your mind. And then when it comes to next level up, in terms of IMT, for example, I suppose your next thing is then trying to get some of the skills under your belt. Mm. So it'd be good. There'll be all sorts of pleural aspirations, pleural taps, chest drains. These are the sorts of things that you want to get as much experience as you can, because they are an expected outcome on your portfolio for IMT, but also as a med reg, when you're at that stage, you will be expected to be competent at sticking a chest drain in at 2 o'clock in the morning for somebody who's got a pneumothorax. And if you haven't done very many of them, or you've only ever done it in the skills lab, you're not going to feel that confident about doing it, and it's going to be a bit scary. Whereas if you actually, you've done a good number of them on your SHO rotation, the skills come back and it's much easier to do it in an emergency situation as the med reg who's in charge. Mm. So in terms of as an SHO, I'd just say just make the most of the opportunities. I mean, in every single job that anybody does as a junior doctor, there are patients that need to be seen, there's admin that needs to be done. Mm. You need to do your ward round, you need to do your clerkings, you need to do your discharge letters, all that sort of thing. The job doesn't necessarily require a difference between an F1 and a IMT3 from that point of view, but actually what you will get more out of is going down to clinic and seeing the patients who have been inpatients, and who then, because the other thing is in respiratory you get used to people looking really sick, and actually it's really really nice when they come back to clinic 6 weeks later and they're recovered and their chest x-ray is better and all that kind of stuff. So just get used to asking about chest x-rays, get used to asking about CTs, test yourself on them and see if you can see what then gets mentioned on the ward round. Mm. Just gain those skills, because there's a lot of sort of very nuanced skills that I suppose we do and we don't even notice that we're doing it. And it's just that difference between, you know, when you've sent somebody for a CTPA, have a look at the images first, see if you can spot the PE, and then read the report, or see if you notice anything else and then read the report. And it's the way that you'll learn, you know, radiology. And again, when you become a med reg, that becomes really handy, because if you've got a delay on the CTPA report but you can recognise something quite specific, that's great. So just gradually increase those skills, I suppose. But there's so many opportunities in respiratory to learn all sorts of really important skills.
Thank you very much for the really practical advice. That's really useful. Final question, and then we'll sign off, is would you rather spend the day with wet socks or with a popcorn kernel stuck in your teeth?
Wet socks.
You would be the opposite.
It's quite strongly opposed to wet socks.
I hate having something in my teeth. It really annoys me.
I would agree with you. Yeah. I spent the day with wet socks on Saturday. I mean,
savage.
I did.
I mean, they warm up after a while, don't they? Yeah. But at least the thing stuck in your teeth. That's
I went for a walk and stepped in a bog the first thing, and then
that's
spent
annoying. The
rest of the day. With
so
wet
you'd have actually had wet, smelly socks then, because if it was a bog.
No, yeah, I mean I couldn't smell them because it was outside, but
right. They
probably were. Not great. Anyway, on that note, it's been great having you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Absolute pleasure.
This has been Contingency FM.